The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. Before beginning our program, we would like to invite you to sign up for a free trial subscription to one of our publications at irei.com. Whether you are interested in real estate, infrastructure, or real assets in general, IREI has a publication to suit your needs. Select Publications on the main menu to choose a publication. Interested in more than one? Sign up for them all.
This is Mike Consult with Jeff Dorman. Welcome to the Dorman Report. It is the end of February, and I'm fighting a cold like a lot of people are, so please excuse any nasal inflection that I bring to this conversation. You know, before we started recording, Jeff and I were talking about this seemingly intractable problem with housing in the United States. There's lots of great housing, but there's also a shortage of housing, and that's pushed prices higher along with some other factors. And Jeff, you were talking about the ability to address the problem has been staunched by several factors. Why don't you talk a little bit, reiterate for our listeners what you had started to tell me?
Well, actually, it's a position that was brought to my attention by Jim Pugash, who was the original founder of Hearthstone. Jim passed away a few years ago. But Jim said that the problem with household formations versus issuance of housing permits in the West and in the East Coast really has a lot to do with the pressure that municipalities are facing in terms of limited capacity of the water systems and the electrical grid. I mean, in California, there hasn't been a new water project built since 1970s, really. And yet the population has more than doubled over that period of time. And so consequently, there's, you know, rolling
brownouts.
There's rolling brownouts that occur on the electrical grid because the electrical grid also is insufficient. And then there is, drought restrictions imposed from time to time and increasingly more frequently on the residents because of the limited supply of water relative to the demand. So this is a problem. Municipalities really have a vested interest in issuing permits, other than the political considerations of NIMBYism, where people, you know, already are in place and don't want to see more density built up around them in their neighborhoods. But, you know, there's traffic problems. We haven't had a great deal of money spent in developing new roadways in California. And again, you know, the limitations on the existing grid restrictions and water systems are real and inhibit, you know, the kind of permitting that would allow us to develop enough housing to keep the housing prices from skyrocketing as they have in the past in areas on the East Coast and the West Coast where people want to live.
Why no new water projects in California, though? What's the inhibition there?
I think, you know, part of it is just the lack of funding for infrastructure in general that's occurred. We all know that because, you know, we're focused on infrastructure as well as real estate. We all know that the need for new infrastructure as well as retrofitting of existing infrastructure hugely outweighs the amount of money that's available to fund those things. This is why people increasingly are turning to the private sector to fund those kind of projects. But then there's also taxpayer pushback because they don't really understand the nature of infrastructure investing. You know, in many cases, infrastructure investing is not about selling assets to third parties or privatizing assets. It's about selling the contract to manage those assets to third parties. And if there's not enough money to finance those in the public sector because of increasing demands on the public sector to meet other needs, it's only the private sector that can fill that gap. But so many times these projects are moving down the road to get privatized and taxpayers rise in revolt and try to interfere with the process because they're worried about somebody else owning their assets. It's not what this is about. It's not what this is about.
So it's characterized, the people who resist it, they characterize it as a corporate takeover of what should be a city's assets. And it's really nonsense.
Well, and the other issue that curtails the development of new water projects and, you know, hydroelectric projects that go along with them is environmental concerns. You know, the West is increasingly concerned about preserving wilderness areas and habitat. And these kind of projects tend to disrupt that. And so there's a lot of pushback when these projects are proposed. And so you have a conflict between the needs for human beings to be able to have affordable housing and the needs to preserve the environment that draws them to those areas to begin with. So there's no easy solution to any of these problems. There really isn't.
No.
And then when it comes to NIMBYism, you know, everybody wants to make sure that the homeless get off the streets as long as they're not locating them next to them. So, you know, people's level of compassion is limited when it comes to how much their families are going to be exposed to the homeless element. And so that's part of the reason that there aren't better solutions to it. And then, you know, when you talk about the homeless problem, you know, the homeless live on the streets in a lot of cases because the alternatives just aren't very viable for them. You know, there's shelters, but if they go to the shelters, they get beat up and robbed. There's places they can go get served food, but they don't have to live there to get that. So a lot of people choose to live out on the streets because it's better than the
options.
Well, it's run out of options. They run out of options, and the alternatives that are being provided by the social service network aren't very viable because they're dangerous for them. So it's sad to think that in our society, it's safer for people to live out on the street than it isn't to live in the shelters that people are trying to provide to protect them. But that's the way it is. So again, these are complicated problems without easy solutions. And that's probably why they haven't been solved. And the political environment can have a lot to do with it too. I mean, there's a reason why there's a greater homeless problem in Los Angeles and San Francisco than there are perhaps in some other major metro areas. And a lot of it has to do with the way in which the political environment has been directed to address the problem. And it actually creates a more welcoming environment for them to live there, as well as the climatic issues, because you know, it's a hell of a lot easier to weather a winter in California than it is in New York.
You know, let's talk a minute about, I mean, it's a horrible problem. I mean, all these years later, we still have this homeless problem. And it only seems to be getting worse.
It is getting worse.
Yeah, exactly. And we had talked before we started recording about Scottsdale being, there's this the beautiful city of Scottsdale having a development held up for shortage of water, lack of water. And we haven't moved really very much on recycling water or using desalination plants and so on. We haven't really tackled that problem either. And that's part of the issue, not the biggest part of it, but certainly part of it.
Well, there's a tipping point that occurs in these technologies, right? Where it becomes more cost effective to use the alternative technologies to do things like desalinization. And we're not there yet. Right now, there's a lot of debate about the emergence of electrical vehicles because the production of the batteries for those and the disposing of the batteries for those create as many problems to the environment as gas-powered vehicles provide, just different kinds of problems of toxicity. The solution could be hydrogen technology, and a lot of companies are working to perfect hydrogen technology, but it hasn't been cost-effective yet. When it does become cost-effective, the only really side effect of hydrogen technology deployment is the creation of water. That's not a bad thing. So, you know, that could be the salvation. You know, we tend to look at these problems as static problems. They're not going to change. And the reality of it is they're all changing because the technologies that address the problems are changing. And the need, as they become greater, eventually gets addressed. You know, it's interesting to note that in the late 1890s, right before the advent of the automobile, the biggest concern of people living in the cities is that it was going to become untenable because of the continued accumulation of horse manure.
Yeah.
Right? No.
It stunk. It stunk, and there's a lot of flies around.
And people thought they were going to be up to their ankles to up to their knees in it. And of course, that didn't happen because technology came in and solved the problem. You know, and it wasn't based on market research or anything else. It was just based on industry's response to a need. You know, Henry Ford said that if he asked people what they wanted they would have said they wanted a faster course. So people who thought differently about these problems are the ones that came up with solutions. And my guess is that's going to happen in the future as well. And maybe something other than hydrogen technology will come along that'll be even better. Who knows?
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, we recently had a podcast with Aaron Tartakovsky. He's the co-founder of, and CEO of Epic Cleantech. And he made the point that there's only 2% of U.S. water, of wastewater, that's recycled. And you compare that to other countries where they, a very large percentage. And I said, well, what's the issue? He said, it's just a yuck factor. People don't like knowing that this was wastewater, even though it's been processed to the point where it's absolutely clean, it's pure water. And just the thought of that. Now, I'm not one to complain because I'm one of those guys who's a vegetarian because I don't like the thought of what gets it to the table for me. But when it comes to water, this is just the sort of thing where we become our own worst enemy because we don't like drinking recycled water when it's probably cleaner than anything else that's available out there other than maybe spring water.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, Singapore, for example, uses a lot of reprocessed wastewater, purified reprocessed wastewater. It's a little easier in a country like Singapore where the government is very socialistic and top down and can make those changes because it doesn't matter really what the populace thinks about it. And then people get used to it and then it doesn't become an issue anymore. But in a country like ours, where anything that people attempt to do in government is instantly resisted by some sector of the population, it's really harder to get things done from a political standpoint.
What about cities that have adequate water? Say the, I forget what they call it there, the whole Cincinnati, Ohio area. That's a huge water basin there. They've got lots and lots of water. They're capable of building new housing. The water is there. The energy is there. And yet Florida, not enough gets built because there's some other factors there. I mean, you mentioned the NIMBYism. It's not just homeless, the homeless, let's house the homeless, but not next to me, please. But also just, do we really need more cars on the road? Do we need more people going to the schools that my kids go to and so on?
An example of that, Mike, is I grew up in Fairfax, California. It's in Marin County, and it's about 10 miles from the major freeway artery. It used to take us from Fairfax to the freeway 10, 15 minutes, and now can take as long as an hour. And that's because the population of West Marin has grown tremendously, but they're using the same road network they were using in the 1950s.
Yeah.
And that's happening all over the place. So what happens if you're a homeowner, particularly if you're a homeowner who's been here for a long time, like my father-in-law, who occupied the same house for 47 years? He just blames the developers. You know, the developers are making life miserable and lowering our quality of life. Well, to a certain extent, they are, but that's because people want to live next door to them. And they don't want people to live next door to them because they like the fact that they have open vistas of the, you know, beautiful landscape around them. They don't want to share that with other people. That's why they moved there in the beginning, because it was so beautiful. And now it's getting paved over and they don't like it.
Yeah.
So I don't know what you do about that. You know, you mentioned Scottsdale. Well, of course, Scottsdale has no water. It's in the middle of a desert. There's no water. That's why it's called the desert, right? So all the water that they use has to be imported from somewhere else. And that's expensive and costly. And the population of places like Scottsdale has been exploding.
Yeah.
During
COVID, I think Phoenix, the Phoenix area was the biggest growth city in the United States. A lot of people headed to Phoenix.
But they're going to work from home and they're not going to be able to go in the office. Doesn't matter where they live. So why not live someplace that's warm? And a lot of people who used to vacation in those areas are now moving there. Same thing's happening in Florida. You know, people that used to vacation here are moving here and making it their permanent residence. You know, it's warmer. It feels like vacation. There's no state income taxes. The government here, despite the controversy over the leadership, actually works. You don't have to wait, you know, for hours on end when you go in for your appointment to get your driver's license. You walk in on your appointment time and you walk out 45 minutes later with your driver's license in your hand. It doesn't happen in places like California.
Right. People hate it. I mean, at least it's gone online, but people, I mean, that was such a common complaint, just DMV. It's like you're going to spend a day there. You're going to be, you're going to run into problems there. Now, a lot of that is done online, thank God, because it's made such a difference. But, you know, I've always wondered about this whole shifting to the Sun Belt and such in the Southeast and so on, Jeff. The Carolinas, another big growth, a couple of growth states there. But I'm wondering, you got this whole Midwest that a lot of people overlook, the Northeast, which has kind of been hollowing out over time to warmer climes, especially as people get older. I think there's some real housing opportunities there for the people who are gainfully employed or they're retiring with a pension of some kind or a 401k to be able to go back to some of these beautiful places that they're cold, but they're beautiful, they're historic, and they're affordable because a lot of people are moving out. So I wonder if we're not going to see some kind of backwashing going on there as well.
Well, I think
that's speculation.
Yeah, no, my guess is there probably will be. But there, you know, also there are people that grow up in an area and never leave. I mean, most of the friends I grew up with in high school still live in Marin County.
Yeah.
They live live within 10 miles of the house that they grew up in. And there's a certain comfort in being around familiar surroundings. And so you have to balance that against people that are moving for whatever reason.
Yeah. You know? Let me add that the Pittsburgh was the city that years ago. Now, research would have to be done again, but this was about 20 years ago. They did a survey and found that of the largest 25 or 50 cities, more people stayed in Pittsburgh. They were less likely to move out of their city than any other city in the United States. People love their Steelers. They love their Iron City beer, and they love Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And I don't know if you've been there anytime recently, Jeff, but they have done. You talk about a city that went from steel, and really the loss of steel making in the United States to become a high tech and education city with Carnegie Mellon and University of Pittsburgh, and I'm overlooking another major university there. But just did a beautiful job of reincarnating their city for modern times.
You know, I haven't really been to Pittsburgh probably for 25 years, been a long time. But I take your point. You know, there's a lot of cities that are reinventing themselves. Detroit is still a mess, but they're making a lot of progress in repositioning that city as well. There are areas in Connecticut that have been devastated by the collapse of GE Capital and the shrinking of GE's business. They're recovering from that as well. So, you know, no matter how horrible things might seem at a particular given point in time, they're usually just making a transition to whatever's next. I'm pretty optimistic about most things. You know,
does that include housing?
Yeah, I think we'll solve the housing problem someday.
Let me throw one other ingredient into the stew that is feeling intractable right now, and that's insurance. Oh, there's insurance companies pulling out of California, pulling out of Florida. They don't, supposedly, the actuarial charts. I mean, they just can't chart this stuff anymore because it's become so unpredictable.
Insurance companies cannot stay in business if claims exceed earnings on assets. So they have to be careful of what risks they underwrite. And when they look at states like California that don't seem to be doing anything to interfere with the process that have led to huge wildflowers, flooding, and some things they can't do, like, you know, can't do anything about, like flooding and weather problems. It's just easier to pull out. They can't absorb the risks. And so that is going to be a continuing problem in states that are particularly affected by weather change issues, including my own Florida. You know, every year, parts of Miami and Fort Lauderdale flood. It seems like every year the west coast of Florida gets hit hard by hurricanes whose surges come in and just inundate houses. And it's really expensive. And so it's very difficult now to get coverage for homeowners, particularly if you're in a floodplain. You know,
and if you do, you're paying through the nose.
Through the nose. And this is true not just for homeowners, it's also true for people that own commercial property and apartment property. You know, in some cases, the insurance costs have doubled and tripled. So, yeah, it's a real concern.
And I don't see the government can't afford to insure. And insurance companies can't figure a way to be profitable with all this unpredictability and huge disasters.
The government does insure, not through traditional insurance means, but through FEMA, because they're the source of remediation of last resort when a disaster hits. That's why they were put into place. So the last backstop for homeowners and property owners is going to be FEMA. And that means it's going to be you and me, the taxpayers that support it.
Yeah. Yeah. And they show up only when it's a disaster. And
or,
I don't know
or
how
when
effective
the president
are they...
declares their disaster.
Exactly. And I don't know how effective they really are. I mean, and I'm not beating up on a federal agency. They're all limited by the resources that Congress gives them. When a disaster happens and FEMA shows up, a lot of times people, you know, of course, Americans love to complain. We're pampered by comparison to most countries, but we do love to complain about lack of resources or government responsiveness and so on. It's a big, the whole insurance thing is just a huge problem.
A huge problem. And it's one that's been discussed at length at VIP and also at our editorial advisory board meetings. It never even showed up on the agendas a few years ago. There isn't an agenda that we can create that's developed by the participants today that doesn't include insurance as one of the top issues they want to talk about.
The most recent VIP conference, that was a great discussion. We had two insurance experts up there talking about insurance. It was a great discussion and it was really illuminating. There were a lot of questions from the audience. You know, you hit a vein when the audience is asking a bunch of questions. We ran out of time before the questions were done. So
yeah,
that says a lot right there.
That seems to happen at all of our VIP sessions. And I think part of the reason for it is that the advisory board that actually works with John Hunt to produce the agendas and the program and recruit the speakers is really focused only on the issues that are important to investors. And it's not like we're sitting here trying to come up with what we think is going to be important. We really rely on the investor only and consultant only advisory boards to come up with those issues. You know, years ago, we used to have investment managers on those advisory boards. And while they had a lot of intelligent ideas, a lot of times they were somewhat self-serving because, for example, if there was somebody on the advisory board who had a debt program, invariably they're going to recommend a debt discussion, even if the investors really weren't interested in debt at that particular point in time.
Mm-hmm.
But by making sure that it's only investors and consultants that are providing us with the input on what we should be focusing on, we always come up with a program that's really top of mind for the investor community. And of course, that's our mission. Everything we do is investor focused. So that's very consistent with what we do and why we're in business, which is to help investors create better investment outcomes. That's the ultimate reason why we're in business.
So as an optimist, as you declare yourself, and so am I, as you've already indicated, Jeff, things come along that nobody's even envisioning and suddenly starts to solve a problem. But if you were to look out, 10, 20 years, do you have any vision at all as to what you think housing could become down the road? And I would just add to this while you're...
I can tell you what it's going to become for me. It's going to become seniors housing.
Well, and there's a lot of that out there that's being built and invested in. After COVID, they really took a hit during and in the immediate aftermath of COVID, but it appears that they have really come back.
Well,
and they learned a lot of lessons from COVID.
Yeah, the interesting thing about COVID is it's people misunderstood what really happened in the senior housing sector. Where the problems really occurred were where there was great density. So it and not a lot of staff to be able to to serve them. So that tended to occur more in nursing homes and things of that nature than it really did in assisted living or independent living facilities, where people were living pretty normal lives. They just had assistance from professionals. So, I don't think the whole senior living industry as a can be painted with the same brush. You know, it's just sectors of the senior living industry that were hard hit by COVID.
Yeah, Boston was one city that got really smashed. The senior housing centers or the nursing homes there got hit really hard. But in Florida, DeSantis had focused on the nursing homes and really secured those. He did well with that. I mean, and look, I'm not a Republican or a Democrat, never belonged to either party, never will. So I'm not taking any political sides on this thing. I'm just saying that when you have to operate strategically, and for all the criticism he did receive, he operated strategically there. And in the end, according to the statistics on this, California, which shut down a lot, did only very marginally better than states like Texas and Florida, which really kept things open. Yeah. and really told people who were, look, if you're at risk, take precautions, do what you need to do to protect yourself. But the rest of you who are of sound mind and body, we move forward. And that really worked.
Yeah, well, DeSantis was focusing on the small business owner and the people who work for small businesses. And he kind of intuitively got that if he continued to shut those down, that they would be gone from business and many of them never come back. And that's really what happened in California.
Yes. It was rough, very rough.
And I don't know what your position on these whole things are. You know, my position on COVID is that, you know, the media tends to overhype these things, and fear actually can trigger disease that otherwise wouldn't be happening. And
yes.
I think in a lot of ways, the COVID epidemic was fueled by fear-mongering, the part of the media and the government.
Yeah.
That's my personal opinion.
Well, you know,
it's another form of
the placebo effect. Yeah. Aaron Rodgers. Yeah. What about Aaron?
Well, Aaron Rodgers was severely criticized because of the stance that he took around COVID. But I think in some ways he was probably right. You know, and look at the guy. I mean, he's almost fully recovered and back on the playing field after less than a year. He really does know something about how the mind impacts the way in which we recover and the way in which we're exposed to disease processes.
It's always underrated, the mental aspect of really every aspect of life it tends to be underrated. And that's part of what makes people susceptible, that when they're fed a lot of information that oftentimes the mind reacts to that. As you say, you can be made sick just by embracing information that it's flu season, you're stuffed up, you need these pills, and so on and so forth.
Or, you know, you already have the shingles, you know.
It's in your body.
It's in your body. It's just waiting to come out. So probably a lot of people go seek treatment for something that statistically is very unlikely to ever happen to them. You know, we're so driven by the pharmaceutical companies and their advertising programs to consume substances to solve our problems instead of to get our heads straight.
Yeah, it's a lot of fear-based. You mentioned fear. It's fear-based living.
Yeah. And, you know, I think, you know, that has the same thing happens with the homeless problem and all sorts of other issues. You know, I think I've mentioned this before. There's been some research that suggests that people buy a lot more luxury goods and spend more money when they're not feeling good about themselves. So there's a reason why the media focuses on the negative. There's a reason why the news is so depressing, you know, because it creates a better market for the products that support the news broadcasts.
Yeah. And people need to understand that and wrap their heads around that whole concept. And you know, none of that information really gets out there unless you seek it. I mean, what I'm saying, Jeff, is I don't think people understand the whole psychological component of this unless you actually go out there and seek it. There's no public service announcements about this kind of thing. It's not something that the government's in the business of putting out to the population.
It's people who
take an interest and read about these sorts of things, pay attention.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is whenever you see it, including the thing I just mentioned, whenever you see something that starts with, studies found that, you got to look deeper and say, what the hell are they selling? Because almost always,
who paid for the study?
Almost always, there's a reason why a study shows something, right? And you know, the old famous saying by Disraeli that there's three kinds of lies: lies, damn lies, and statistics. Well, research is based on collecting statistics.
Yeah, exactly. And the whole that whole thing is, I've never seen more studies and surveys and polls than today, because they really do work just in terms of getting people to focus on something and maybe start responding to it with dollars and cents. So the message is, what to our audience is stay healthy, keep your mind focused, be careful where the input comes from, do your own research.
And I think something that we talked about at VIP, you know, we're going through an adjustment in the marketplace, a correction. This is the normal part of market cycles. We've just gone through one of the longest periods of sustained growth in the property markets since they started tracking growth. There are people that are out there working in the real estate investment business that have never seen a downturn. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And it's easy to buy into the media hype that comes out. You know, I've seen press releases across my desk talking about the real estate crisis. What real estate crisis? You know, we've got some secular and cyclical problems in the real estate investment business. The secular ones happen on a regular basis, just been a long time since we had one last time. And the secular problems, the secular problems are things that have to do with changes in work habits, you know, that are prompted by what happened with COVID, regards to office property, and changes in the retail consumer buying patterns. And none of this is a crisis. It's just an adjustment. But whenever you're going through transitions like this, the important thing to keep in mind is that that doesn't mean just because the opportunities that were available last year are no longer available today doesn't mean there aren't a whole new set of opportunities that are available to people. The key is not to look in the same places for the opportunities. When markets are changing, you need to look in new places to find different kinds of opportunities that suit the current market conditions. But there's no lack of opportunities in the market today.
Yeah.
It's just they're not the same as they were a year ago. That's
yeah.
all.
And what you just did, Jeff, was you put things in context. And that's, I think, a bottom line is anything you're looking at, you put it into context, take a look at somewhat of a historical time frame. And as you say, we go through cycles. There's nothing abnormal about this. And every, 75 years, we really have a genuine crisis, but we always come out richer than we went into it. So any reason for the pessimism, really.
The thing to keep in mind is when we went through the great financial crisis, it was a crisis. People were worried about the collapse of the entire financial system on a global basis. There's nothing like that going on right now, right? We're going through a period of time where price discovery is difficult, where financing is scarce and expensive. But it's not a crisis. It's a normal part of the cycle. Where are the opportunities when those kind of conditions occur? Those of us who are seasoned and been around a long time will know where to look. Those who aren't can ask the people that are. But either way, if you keep looking in the same place for the same opportunities, you're going to keep getting the same results, which is nothing. You have to keep your eyes open and start looking in places where the opportunities lied the last time that we were experiencing conditions similar to what we're experiencing now.